Craft matters in small ways, like how coffee is made or how a wooden table is built piece by piece. And in not so small ways, like how your money is cared for. At UBS, we elevate investing to a craft. We deliver our services with passion, expertise, and meticulous attention to detail. This is what investing means to UBS. Not just work, but a craft. Discover more at ubs.com/craft. The value of investments may fall as well as rise, and you may not get back the amount originally invested.
Welcome to the New York Times Popcast, your steady time machine malfunction of music news and criticism. I'm your host, John Caramonica.
My thighs are black and blue. My sheets are stained, so is my brain. What's a girl to do? Oh, what's a girl to do?
Indeed, what is a girl to do? Here we are, about a year globally into the coronavirus pandemic. We continue to lose people at an alarming, unsettling, frustrating clip, including many musicians, many people who've made important contributions to popular music, jazz, and so on. Last year, you may remember we did an episode celebrating three people, celebrating the work of Joe Diffie, Nashawn Wooden, and DJ Black and Mild. I've been wanting to do a follow-up episode, maybe two follow-up episodes. So this week, we are going to look back at the lives of Christina. We're going to look back at Fred the Godson, and we're going to look back at Adam Schlesinger from Fountains of Wayne. Each of them very, very distinctive in their respective fields. So we're going to go long this week. We've got Kurt B. Riley calling in to talk about Christina. We've got a friend of the podcast, Ben Cesario, to talk about Adam Schlesinger. And Sean Sitaro is going to join us to talk about Fred the Godson. You're listening to Christina. Christina was art house post-disco, no wave adjacent, Arabesque diva in the early 1980s. Christina passed away in March. She had been ill for some time with a number of autoimmune disorders, and she tested positive for coronavirus right before she passed. She was 64 years old. Christina burned brightly and briefly in downtown New York demimonde in the early 1980s, making kind of an arch rye approach to disco after disco. It was a little bit avant-garde. It was definitely funny, and it was not universally appreciated. Some people thought she was taking the piss too much. Some people thought that the type of records that she was making would be more palatable from perhaps a more accessible type of performer, Madonna. So the legacy of Christina was kind of left laying fallow for a long time until the early 2000s, when her first two albums on Z Records were reissued. To talk about Christina today, we're talking to Kurt B. Riley, who wrote the liner notes for those reissues. Kurt is a DJ, an author, an all-around bon vivant entertainer, lives in Tucson. And also, little known fact, Kurt and I both used to write for the Seattle Weekly at the dawn of the 2000s, at least was very instrumental in my writing career that era. So Kurt, I am happy to have you here. We have never spoken before. I'm glad to be able to speak to you now. How's it going, man?
I am delighted to speak to you. I'm delighted to speak about Christina. And don't make me nostalgic for the era when freelance journalists could actually squeeze out a living.
Absolutely true, right? I mean, it seems so strange to think of a moment where a person in New York at least could write a column for a newspaper in Seattle and like actually get checks for that. It feels eons ago. But true, we won't dwell on that. Let's dwell on Christina. Now, I wonder if you could talk to me about your earliest exposure to Christina, which I presume came many, many years before you were writing those liner notes.
It's true. My first exposure to her was in 1984 when Ooh. Sleep It Off. Yes, people were alive in 1984.
Oh my God. Okay. All right. I got to get an ice pack just to cool myself down from thinking about that. I was not there. I was maybe close to there, but I was not there. Okay. Please right. continue.
So 1984, I pick up an issue of Rolling Stone and I saw this image of a woman with this elongated neck that had been sliced up.
Yes.
And it was a review of a record called Sleep It Off. And between the power of that image, which of course Jean-Paul Gaud later recycled for Grace Jones' Slave to the Rhythm, and the title, I was really intrigued. And I read it, and it opened with this line that was something like, if you enjoyed the Pulitzer divorce trial, you'll love Christina.
When I was writing the obituary, I had not read any of those early reviews of Christina. So I went back and read them all because there was that fan site run by, I believe, a friend of yours that had kind
David
of aggregated.
Gartrell.
Yes. Aggregated all that stuff. And I reread it. I have to say, I think a lot of those reviews missed the point, but they were hilarious.
Which points do you think they missed? Because I think at their best, the appraisal of her career at least is intellectually up to par. I do agree that sometimes they really like weren't on the mark, but at least the writing for the most part about her career was pretty smart. What bothered you?
Well, I think there was that. Well, first of all, there was that. Was it a profile in the Boston Globe that I thought?
Yes.
That story seemed to get it. But I remember thinking in some of the criticism, it's that difference between intentionality and irony, right? And I think that some critics were reading her with intentionality rather than reading her with irony. And I think for her, the irony was intentional, but you couldn't separate the two. I was looking at something on the internet today about like all the GameStop stuff, and someone was tweeting, and it was like, oh, I see these tweets have hit literal Twitter, like capital L, capital T. And I feel like some of the Christina criticism at the time was like literal criticism, capital L, capital C, as opposed to someone who was maybe closer to the scene or maybe understood the kind of the arched eyebrow that was running through it. That's how it felt.
The eyebrow that apparently was arched most of the time, I think you put it really well when you point out it really is about the dovetailing of irony and, I don't want to say authenticity, but...
intention, I think.
Intention. It was intention. She was very self-aware. You know, her background was in writing and theater. She was really aware of the things you could do with performance, the things you could do with lyrics. And a lot of thought went into what she was doing. But she was also sending things up. She was sending up disco. She was sending up rock. She was sending up musical theater. And I do think it was a little too sophisticated for a lot of people.
Let's talk a little bit about the early 80s. So we're coming out of like peak disco era. What's happening around her in New York City? We should say she essentially dropped out of Harvard, I believe, to move to New York with her boyfriend.
She was on a year off from Harvard when she started making records.
And so she comes to New York. What's happening in New York, late 79 into 1980? Let's talk about that scene, because I think that really does provide the context.
Well, the thing you have to remember is that she, to a certain degree, is really part of that scene and its inception. Because when we talk about that late 70s disco scene, you know, we're on the cusp of Disco Sucks. We're on the cusp of the commercial pushback. And disco is evolving really rapidly. And there are these fusions of disco and rock. And we're hearing emerging hip-hop records, rap records in discos. And there's a lot of cross-pollination going on. And Z Records, which was started, co-founded by her husband, Michael Zilka, and released most of her records, was really instrumental in that. The only reason she ever started recording was because Michael purchased the rights, the publishing rights, to a song called Disco Clone. Chris Blackwell called it the most expensive flop in recording history.
Well, let's contribute 0.0001 cent to the royalties of this. This is the original single version of Disco Clone.
Went down to the disco last Saturday night. Ready for action and feeling all right. One lady dancing was such a delight. As we crowded up to meet her, she said,
"Boys, don't fight, I'm Disco Clone."
So in 1978, I believe, her boyfriend at the time, Michael Zilka, buys this song from someone she knows socially from Harvard, from doing theater. I believe his name is Ronald Melrose. He had directed her in productions. And she looked at this song and she was like, you guys, this is a really stupid song. And they were like, but it's about disco and clones. We're going to have a hit. And she was like, the only way you can do this is if you frame it like this. And she started talking about framing it as sort of a Brechtian pastiche. And Michael was like, oh, you're so smart. Okay, let's make a record. And her first few records, that sensibility really informs it. You know, Disco Clone, her cover of the Beatles' Drive My Car, her enjoined version of Is That All There Is, all those early records, those singles, she went in there with the mindset of an actress and really had the entire thing mapped out in her brain. Who her character was, how her character sounded, what was the universe she was functioning in. And I think that's part of what makes her so charismatic. It didn't really matter if technically she was a great singer because she brought so much thought and character to these records.
This would be a good time, I think, to mention. So there's that 1984 New York Magazine article about her and Michael.
The Anthony Hayden guest one. She yes. hated that one.
But there's a good quote about the singing in there. And it's after she has performed her first live performance. Her mother was at her first live performance. And mom says to her, you were always a brilliant writer, a good artist, a good actress. How could you be so self-destructive as to sing? The horror. The
By
horror.
By her own admission. First of all, that's not her first performance. That's her only live performance.
Okay.
The dates with Kid Creole and the Coconuts are the only time she ever performed live. She was frustrated that people didn't necessarily understand what she was trying to do. And I think the self-titled first album does her a disservice by sort of presenting her in a format that most people might have been able to wrap their heads around, i.e., this is a disco record.
These are Kid Creole productions, right?
Exactly. That you're talking about. This was August Darnell road testing stuff he was going to do with the Coconuts. The Coconuts later record Christina songs on their solo record. This was really him figuring out what the Coconuts could be. And the live show basically was a Kid Creole and the Coconut show with pop-ups from Christina, who had no background performing in music. She had never had a band. She'd never been a cabaret singer. Once she got established, such as it was, she really did want to invest time and energy and find a couple musical collaborators that she could develop her act with, because she realized her strengths and limitations as a vocalist and felt strongly that if she had just had suitable foils over a long period that she could rehearse with, that she would have grown as a singer.
One of the interesting things about the No Wave era was there was this kind of implicit interrogation of expertise, right?
Yes.
It's sort of, and this is obviously hand in hand with what's happening in punk, coming out of the punk scene. But there's this idea that maybe you don't quite need to know how to play the instrument. Maybe the art is in the figuring out. Maybe the art is in the imperfection or the inability to achieve perfection. Does Christina's early work not in some way fit in with that larger movement, especially given that she was right there proximate to that scene? It's not as if she was doing this in Indiana. You know, she's doing it literally at the same parties, I imagine.
God, no. Having lived in Indiana, I have hard pressed to imagine Christina living there in the 80s. I mean, I think part of what we're talking about here is that there are layers with Christina. And yes, because she came from a social background, you know, her mother had been a well-known commercial illustrator. And because her boyfriend came from money, she did have this sort of que sera sera, what can we get away with attitude. And she also was smart enough to realize that playing stupid was a tool she could use. So I do think that factors really into the first few records. I mean, there's a very clear delineation in her catalog between the first few singles and the self-titled album. And then she releases Is That All There Is? It was poised to be a hit. Lieber and Stoller come after her and say, destroy all copies of the record. And then the second phase
is humorless scolds.
Well, you know, she has said, she told me that if she and Michael and the label had really had the resources to fight back, she would have fought back on the basis of parody. Because
oh, of course.
The original,
right.
The original song is already a Brecht and Weill pastiche. All she did was turn up the lyrics to 11. But they decided not to invest the money and let it go. There was this sense that, well, you know, we're not going to make money off records, but maybe the scandal will be helpful. But that's really like the dividing line in her career. And then after that, it's things fall apart and what's a girl to do in the second album. And then she quietly retires.
So talk to me a little bit about the distinctions between the first album and the second album. We mentioned that the first album has these kind of Kid Creole records. It's her trying to like almost fit into a pre-existing or newly arrived scheme. But the second record does not do that, or at least not in the same way. You talk a little bit about the difference between the two.
The second record is the one where she is in the driver's seat. The first couple singles, she's collaborating with people she knows, Stoney Browder, August Darnell, John Cale. And then we get to Sleep It Off. She chose Don Was as her producer because she really liked the fact that Was Not Was understood irony and had a deep understanding of myriad music styles. And she really wanted to take advantage of that. Sleep It Off, she wrote almost all the lyrics herself. So she's no longer adapting who she is and mining somebody else's material to find a great performance. She's writing about her own experiences. And in most cases, it's autobiographical. It's just that we're not used to hearing about the sort of things she was writing about in 1984. So people didn't realize it was actually drawn from real life.
This would be a good time to play, oh, I don't know, Don't Mutilate My Mink.
Or He Dines Out on Death, or yeah. Death and Fascination, yeah. Or play Don't Mutilate My Mink, because that was a very intentional choice by her.
And again, this continual play between intention and ironic distance. Here's a song about high living, but also rendered in a way to make you think, is it poking fun at? Is it poking fun from the top down? Is it poking fun from the bottom up, from the outside in or the inside out? So blurry. So yeah. Blurry.
It was inspired in part by The Clash. That was sort of the model she was looking at. Don Was and I have joked that they really should pay Johnny Lydon royalties because it really sounds like a public image song. But The Clash was sort of her jumping off point. And what she was trying to do with that song was something she felt The Clash did, which was interrogate punk sloganeering and not just settle for a couple words, but actually like dig deep and go, what do these things mean? Or what don't they mean? How does what they signify stand at cross purposes with what they actually do mean or what reality is? So even though it's a really succinct, short song, again, it had this deep concept behind it.
Let's talk about popularity.
Okay. something that unfortunately she did not know much about.
Right. Now, when I listen to these songs now with, you know, multiple decades of hindsight, I'm listening and I'm saying, huh, maybe with like the right, oh, I don't know, right record label push or the right DJ, influential DJ, these songs could have maybe ended up as genuinely popular songs. But for the most part, they were not. And I wonder if you could talk a little bit about what was going on with Christina that kept a barrier between her and a wider spread understanding, acceptance, embrace.
Her best work is in 1984. The music industry believes that people cannot handle more than one of any sort of archetype, right? So we've got this one pole that's emerging that's Madonna. And we have this other pole that's established, which is second generation Marianne Faithfull. And Christina is really sort of in the middle in the eyes of a typical record executive who might completely overlook the fact that she has this whole intellectual level going on that isn't really present in either of those women's work. So I think that was part of why she had trouble getting traction. There was also some friction at Island. There was some friction with her manager. And then later, after Sleep It Off kind of stalls, she's married, she becomes a mom.
They moved to Texas.
And moved to Texas with Michael. And she'd always been self-conscious about the fact that her career really had started on a whim. She was proud of the work she did, and she took it very seriously. But again, she wasn't part of the mythology of, you know, little girl from the wrong side of the tracks, loves to sing in her bedroom mirror and starts a band and plays in beer and urine-soaked clubs. Like, she had nothing to do with that. And so she was really self-conscious about her background. And when people were like, eh, you don't count, she kind of took it seriously.
Christina's interview with Time Out New York, done by friend of the podcast, Elizabeth Vincentelli.
God, I love that woman.
Yes, who appeared on our Riot Girl episode. Shout out, Elizabeth. And what Christina told her, and this is around the time of the reissues, I believe, right? This Time Out story. Christina told her, I believe the idea that Michael had bought me a career, Michael, her husband, to such an extent that I felt sheepish and guilty, which I shouldn't have been. So I think that all ties up, which after the record in 84 doesn't really do crazy numbers, doesn't really get picked up on. They moved to Texas. I don't know what the scene was like in Texas in the mid 80s, but probably was not this scene. And then, like you said, she became a mom and sort of like reshifted her focus away from music. And eventually they do divorce. She moves back to New York and she becomes a writer primarily. A lot of her public facing work was in doing kind of literary and artistic criticism.
Exactly. For periodicals in England and the Los Angeles Times Literary Supplement and things like that.
There is a moment where she gets a collaboration. This is right after the reissues come. Ursula 1000 reaches out.
The whole reason I ended up writing the liner notes, I had grown up, as you have now pinpointed, in an era when that sort of post-punk mutant disco thing was actually happening. So when it started to really grow in popularity again in the early 21st century, I was already a fan of it. And now, like, it was easier to find records. I knew a lot more. And I was a big fan of Z Records. And so I had seen that they were reactivating the label and sent Michelle Esteban, who's the other partner, an email and said, hey, you know, next year is the 20th anniversary of Christina's Sleep It Off. Why the haven't you reissued these records? These records need to be reissued. And he basically replied and said, okay, smart guy, I looked you up online. Why don't you write the liner notes? So that's like my point of entry. And Ursula 1000 was already a fellow traveler. I already knew Alex Cimino because of this shared love for post-punk and mutant disco. And he had told me that he was a Christina fan. So when I interviewed her and she mentioned that she had met members of Ladytron, I told her that Alex, Ursula 1000, was really excited about her too and wanted to connect with her. And she said yes. And he basically had a ready-made for her. He had composed a song, Urgent Anxious, that took the best of her first phase and the Marilyn Monroe, oh, I'm just a little girl in the woods kind of voice, and the second phase, where she's much more pointy and arch and distaff, and wrote this great song that celebrated both of them.
Let's listen to a little bit of Urgent Anxious.
Heard it all before. I'll give you seconds to impress me. What do you want more? My sense of self, the panic attack. Let go of my ego, it's back on the rack.
To kind of bring it full circle, writing about Christina as Christina was experienced in that moment, in the early 80s moment, is interesting. Coming at it from the perspective of the late 2010s into the early 2020s, because a lot of the things that probably seemed unusual or overly provocative at that point are now like utterly normalized. It's normal to have wry, ironically detached pop stars. It's normal to have a clash of digital and organic. It's normal to play with class iconography in accessible forms of music. I forget if it was something that you had written or Elizabeth had written. I'm jumbling it all in my head. Electroclash. There's, if you listen to a bunch of electroclash, you hear things that Christina was doing 2 decades before.
I got a Christmas record the other day where somebody covered Things Fall Apart in 2020.
What are the things that Christina helped introduce that did not become genuinely popular or accessible for some time? What are those modes, you think?
Well, I think where she was at a disadvantage is popular music and a keen intellect were not necessarily running on parallel tracks at that point. There are certainly some smart and sensitive artists, but she was really freaking brainy. And I think that that sort of did her a disservice in terms of connecting with people. Again, I think that had she had the opportunity to keep writing, that would have refined over time. It's so funny because I'm so drawn to people like her and Arthur Russell, where when you discover them, you're like, there's no one else like them in the world. And then 30 years later, the world catches up to them.
The world is like them.
You know, she had a really keen mind. She was able to dissect pop music and do things with the flayed body in front of her. And because she came from a background of theater, she really appreciated the potential of what a Cole Porter or a Noel Coward could do, what a really smart, literate pop song could do beyond just triggering a, oh, I feel angry, I feel sad. But she was trying to write songs that prompted listeners to ask questions of themselves, not just have a gut level feeling reaction, but actually listen to lyrics and have to think and look at their own lives and like, how do these things map? She's one of these artists. I love Christina because in conversation, I would have to look up words after we talked. She's like Green Gartside from Scritti Politti. She was so smart. And I really admired that about her. But again, I think she was a little too smart for the room.
Who can relate?
Well, no, as a bubblehead, I have no idea.
Kurt, I appreciate you checking in with us to remember the life and work of Christina. Thanks so much, man.
Thank you so much for taking time to celebrate her.
This podcast is supported by Americans United for Separation of Church and State.
Americans United defends your freedom to live as yourself and believe as you choose, so long as you don't harm others. Core freedoms like abortion rights, marriage equality, public education, and even democracy itself rest upon the wall of separation between church and state. Christian nationalists are attacking these fundamental freedoms. Americans United is fighting back. Freedom without favor and equality without exception. Learn more about AU's work at au.org/NYT.
I'm Emily Badger. I'm a reporter with the New York Times. Since the pandemic, empty office buildings have become much more common in many cities. Why can't we just turn them into housing? It's actually a really complicated question. To answer this question, you have to find a developer trying to turn an office building into apartments, ride a rickety elevator to the 30th floor of a construction site to see the interior guts of a building. Finds an expert in incandescent light bulbs who can explain to you how they fundamentally change office buildings. And that's just the beginning of what you have to do. When you subscribe to the New York Times, you are sending reporters like me out into the world to ask questions of dozens of different experts, to go and visit places most people don't get to go, to try to come back with answers, and then turn all of that into something that anyone can understand. If you'd like to become a subscriber, head to nytimes.com/subscribe. You need to see the animated floor plans in this piece.
I wanna sink to the bottom with you. I wanna sink to the bottom with you. The ocean is big and blue. I just wanna sink to the bottom.
Just listening to Sink to the Bottom, that is from the first Fountains of Wayne album back in 1996. Adam Schlesinger, the creative engine of Fountains of Wayne, was an early Corona victim. He passed away in early April at 52. Ben Cesario, our music business reporter and big Schlesinger Fountains of Wayne fan, wrote the obituary. Ben is here to tell us about the life of Adam Schlesinger, musical output and influence. Ben, hello, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, of course. Of course. So we were listening to an early Fountains of Wayne song as we came in. I wonder if you could talk a little bit at the beginning before we get too deep on their influence and kind of sort of big thinky approach. In the mid 90s, what kind of role did Fountains of Wayne play when they arrived? What were they reacting to? What were they an extension of or a kind of counterpoint to? I feel like that's a very specific year to be a newish rock band in the mainstream or on a major label.
You know, the term that usually gets applied to Fountains of Wayne right at the top is power pop, which is accurate. But I feel like at the very beginning, we were still in this like post-grunge chainsaw guitars kind of time. And that first Fountains of Wayne record has a bit of that. It's like a very mid-90s record for that reason. It has some like slamming angry choruses and that kind of thing. But it wasn't hard to see that within that there was a real expert craft at work of songwriting and of the devotion to like the Beatles and the Kinks and Big Star and that sort of continuum of like rock music with very strong pop bones and like a sophistication of form and of lyricism.
I hadn't listened to this record in well over a decade, and I was listening to it earlier today, and I've forgotten kind of how dirty sounding it is, certainly compared to like later Fountains of Wayne stuff.
I feel like that's just the production context that they emerged from. Just like if you heard a band in 1985, it would have had the gated snare drum and that kind of stuff. And so they were partly just a product of that. But I think that one of the things that is clear when you go back on it is that there's still that very strong voice of a songwriting voice. And the next record, Utopia Parkway, which came out in 99, I think is my favorite. And that's the one that's like, it's a very like Ray Davies-esque sort of concept album about a location in America. And the location is basically like the outer boroughs of New York City.
Should we listen to something off this record? Because sure. I agree, this is a great album.
Red Dragon Tattoo is like the great one for me.
Perfect. Let's do it. Red Dragon Tattoo on Utopia Parkway. Red Dragon Tattoo. Let's talk about songwriting subject matter, which you were just kind of getting into. Not only are the songs on this record sort of extraordinarily tuneful and very, very cleanly structured, like very solid and sturdily structured, but the subject matter, as you mentioned, is particular and sort of at odds with all of the other mainstream rock of that era, right? I mean, we're in, what, 98, 99 at this point. So like mainstream rock or major label rock, we're moving into rap rock, we're, you know, arena size stuff. There's something very poetic and quotidian about the kind of things that Fountains of Wayne is singing about.
There's a lot of like snapshots of loser and slacker life in New York City. And, you know, Red Dragon Tattoo is about a guy who like goes to Coney Island to get a tattoo to impress a girl. And you just know that it's not going to work. And there's a song called Laser Show, which is about like getting stoned as a teenager and going to the Hayden Planetarium and seeing like the Dark Side of the Moon laser show, The Valley of Malls. You know, that's a title that kind of says it all. Like even the album title, which is also the name of the first track on it, is called Utopia Parkway, which is a road in Queens. So, you know, it's kind of about a small scale look at life in New York, of the lives of particular people, of, you know, sort of like crappy cover bands and teenagers and like the loser trying to impress a girl, with a lot of clever references thrown in there. One of the things that Fountains of Wayne, I thought, always did very well is there's a lot of like winking, insidey references to other music. And it, in a way, that kind of put a limitation on them, because I think it can only really be appreciated by other rock nerds, but it's in there. And, you know, like when they sort of name check Metallica or the guy from Korn as the like model of the tattooed dude, I find those kind of things like comic touches that really reflect somebody who's as much of a student of pop music as an artist.
This world, this is not a scene that I was in at all during this time. But in retrospect, can you tell me, either positively or negatively, what kind of overlap was there between what Fountains of Wayne was doing in terms of subject matter, texture, and also just obviously being on a major, at least at this point, and the kind of emergent indie rock scenes of the 90s, your Matadors, your Merges, things like that? Was there some kind of natural kinship, or were they perceived as slightly apart from it because they were so focused on tunefulness and there's always like a pop understanding underneath their music?
It's funny to hear you say that it's not your world, because I felt like it was very much my world, like mid-90s indie pop in New York. And the, you know, I mean, I felt like they were supreme, you know, like they were viewed as one of the greats from the very start. And I don't think they were at all at odds with the rest of the scene. I mean, I felt like them, maybe Teenage Fan Club, another one of my favorites that has a very similar songwriting approach in some ways. You know, it's like a Gen X trope that like they were perfect, yet they were also doomed. You know, like there was the sense that, you know, like the Magnetic Fields or something, like they were so good at what they did and it was so smart, yet they were never going to be the Beatles. They were never going to be superstars. And when they did actually have their hit a few years later with Stacy's Mom, that's when I feel like there was a bit of a backlash, because it's a great song, but it feels a little dumbed down. It feels a little like too much of a novelty. At least it did at the time. When I listen back at it now, I just think it's like pure joy. But, you know, I do think at the time that was a strange moment for them, where you couldn't really call them the indie rock band anymore, even though they were now dropped from the major.
Right. They're actually on an independent.
Yeah. They paid for the record themselves, but they had the like video with a supermodel on it. And it was actually a radio hit. And that, I think, was a little bit of an albatross for them, that that was their one hit, at least as a band.
Yes. And just as a quick sidebar, I'm glad you mentioned Magnetic Fields and also Teenage Fan Club, because obviously there is that thread through the 90s of, you know, indie pop, tuneful indie pop bands that are not mopey and staring away from the cameras and so on and so forth. So that is definitely one viable thread. And it's interesting to think of them alongside Magnetic Fields. Shout out my guy, Alex Mulcahy, who took me to the 69 Love Songs Magnetic Fields show at Knitting Factory, whatever year that was, at the OG Knitting Factory. But hearing a Stephen Merritt alongside a Schlesinger, I think, makes a tremendous amount of sense. I'm really glad that you put those two together. Stacy's Mom. We should listen to Stacy's Mom, which I agree seemed so like at the moment, and now just seems like, oh, that's fine. That makes sense. So here's Stacy's Mom from the third Fountains of Wayne record, which is called Welcome Interstate Managers. Stacy's Mom. Fountains of Wayne, Stacy's Mom, big video, big MTV hit, right?
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
This song. So, which, you know, is funny because you wouldn't necessarily think of Fountains of Wayne as a band that would have a hit cycled through that route. But clearly they made a choice. I think they knew what they had on their hands and they chose to do a big video for it. At the time, you found it disruptive, you were saying?
It wasn't just me. I mean, I had no negativity toward it, but I mean, I think it like it kind of challenged the narrative a little bit. And there was a bit of a, you know, journalistic debate happening over like, are they still cool kind of the thing? right?
I remember, you remember those debates? Yeah. Those seem like 100 years ago. Jeez.
But, you know, the thing is that Fountains of Wayne was only sort of one part of what he was all about. So, he, you know, he wrote this song in 1996 for the movie That Thing You Do, which is like a an ironic imitation Beatles-y type song. And it was for this movie about this band that has the one hit that, you know, they can never follow it up. It's a perfect early 60s pop novelty type song. And I actually think that came out before the first Fountains of Wayne album did.
Let's listen to a bit of That Thing You Do, which showcases not just Schlesinger's songwriting, but also a keen historical ear. So here's someone who, even as he's making music that's quote-unquote contemporary music, and but it is very much bolstered, it sits on the shoulders of all this earlier music history. He's someone who is very, very mindful of how songs have been put together in a pop way for decades and decades and decades before him. What are the commonalities in your mind between being a person who can do this kind of like pinpoint recreation for this film and also can do what he was doing in Fountains of Wayne? What are the common threads?
Well, first of all, I think just the basics of songwriting. Adam Schlesinger and Fountains of Wayne represent sort of a strain of pop and rock music that's mainly based around chords and melodies, as opposed to the stuff based more around riffs and beats. And that you hear, of course, more in hip hop, but that's also basically like Led Zeppelin. I think if you lined up all the beats and riffs from Fountains of Wayne songs, they would not be very interesting. They'd be the same thing over and over again. But if you looked at them as sort of hooks based on chord progressions and melodies and lyrical themes, the inventiveness would be astonishing. And I think that this strain of pop music has more in common with things like Broadway and TV and film music, which is why I think Adam was so good in those genres too.
He wrote or was one of the main writers on Crazy Ex-Girlfriend, the television show, the Rachel Bloom show that had a lot of original music.
Where he wrote like dozens and dozens of songs for that show. I was amazed by just how much music. I mean, I'd seen the show, but I, you know, until he died and more information came out, I wasn't aware of like just how much music he was generating for that show. I think it was like over 100 songs.
Let's listen to one of his songs. It's called Let's Generalize About Men.
Gay men.
Oh, no, they're fine.
So here's someone who a number of successful albums with his band, but also could reinvent and reshape himself, making songs for Broadway, songs for television, songs for film, songs in different modalities. Someone who was maybe better known for the specific kind of vibrations that he would hit in these different fields than himself. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I always felt like he was kind of a cipher as a person. You know, he did interviews, he was out there, but he didn't have a really big personality. You know, I mean, he always came across to me as a guy who was more comfortable just making the music. And in fact, I think he had a studio where he did a lot of his own work. And so, you know, I always felt like he as a person, I was always kind of curious about him, but I always felt like it was more about the work. It was more about his music, and that's kind of really where you saw what he was all about. It was so shocking when he died. He was only 52, and even though he's a bit older than me and like I never met him, it felt like a real contemporary to me. And so I think he was the first person to die of coronavirus that really like kind of hit home for me.
Ben, thanks for taking some time to talk about Adam Schlesinger.
Thank you.
We open up a new chapter. Spread the gospel's take on it all.
Biggie's wittiness, Jay-Z sarcasm. The words a big pun when the God's spazzing. Nas wisdom, Eminem's lyricism. Big L's freestyle, I hate criticism. Well, perhaps they leave, scared to rap with me. Flow groundbreaking, I pray for the Japanese. And deep door 750 on it.
What you were just listening to are some of the signature square-cornered bars of Fred the Godson. Fred passed away from the coronavirus last April. He was, apparently it's a source of some debate on the internet, he was 41. Most of the obituaries say that he was 35. Voter records indicate that he was 41, which is why that's the, for those who had been asking on Twitter months ago, that's where we got the information from voting records. Fred was, I don't want to say the last of a disappearing breed, but when it came to a certain style of New York rap that was obviously very in vogue in the 90s and slightly less so in the 2000s, Fred, who was from the Bronx, was one of the people really keeping that flame alive. When I would listen to Fred the Godson raps, it really reminded me of listening to New York radio 10 years prior, 15 years prior. His interest in maintaining that form, having reverence for it, and keeping it vital was something that always really struck me as someone who grew up on that stuff. And also, I would say probably, if we're being honest, diminished his big broad-based potential commercial appeal because the genre was, broadly speaking, moving away from those frameworks. But Fred left behind a series of really, really strong mixtapes, freestyles that will just like blow your ears off your head if you pay attention to the detail in them. To talk about Fred's career and work, we've got Sean Sataro here. Sean works at Complex. He's a writer and reporter there. He also created and hosts the Cypher podcast, which I highly recommend. Go check that out. Sean, what's good, man? How are you? Welcome to Popcast.
Thank you, John. Thanks for having me on this. I'm so excited. I'm a big fan of the show, so it's great to be here and, you know, great and sad to be talking about Fred.
Many of the artists who have been lost to Corona, many of the folks are older. Fred is one of the youngest ones that I'm aware of, youngest musicians that lost to Corona. He had been hospitalized for a few weeks before he passed away. Sean, you both interviewed Fred and also wrote about his legacy in the wake of his passing. I wonder if you could talk, before we kind of get into his backstory, I wonder if you can tell me a little bit about your conversation with him. How did he perceive himself in the context of hip-hop more broadly? When did you talk to him, and what was his perspective on his career at that point?
I talked to him, I think it was 2017, and, you know, first off, somewhat eerily, he was actually late to the interview because he had been having, you know, sort of his own health problems that led to him oversleeping, and he had ongoing, you know, heart, kidney, kind of the whole shebang, sort of a litany of health problems that were apparent even, you know, when I interviewed him. He saw himself as kind of fighting against the grain. What I mean by that is he felt like he existed in a hip hop world where the producer was preeminent and the rapper was secondary. And he wanted to fight against that and reverse it. And in his mind, go back to when rapping was the most important thing about rap.
Right. And which seems quaint, right? You know, it seems, but we have lived through the generational shifts that have moved away from that. Not to sound like old man about it, but hip hop as a genre has grown and evolved to emphasize different parts of the musical package. And, you know, Fred comes from a time that's essentially pre-melody, pre-auto-tune, certainly pre-ascendance of the South in terms of commercial primacy. So he understood that he was sort of practicing almost like in this monastic way of just like, I'm going to commit myself to this small micro section of the art, and that's going to be my thing.
I was so struck by it, and I ended up in the obituary I wrote, I ended up using it as the headline. He said, you know, everyone who knows me knows I'm the last of the Bar Kings.
Yeah, great line. Great, great, great line.
Sure, some of that is you know, normal rapper braggadocio, but that he called himself the last, I think, is notable and goes to what you're saying, that he you know, he saw himself as bucking trends. I think you can kind of hear that too in a lot of the pop culture references he makes are from the 80s, right? Yeah. It's Janet Jackson, it's Crush Groove, or the early 90s, it's Kool Moe Dee, it's Jodeci. He'll slip in like a Billy Dee Williams pun or something. Like, I think there's something kind of intrinsically nostalgic about it, which, you know, not to get too much into the backstory just yet, but I think, you know, some of that comes from growing up in nightclubs in New York. You know, we'll get into it more a little later, but his dad used to bounce at the Tunnel.
Yeah, let's jump right into that. So Fred's from the Bronx, Big Bronx, one of the nicknames that he had. And yeah, his dad did bounce at the Tunnel. And the Tunnel, if you don't know, is sort of this legendary New York nightclub. It was on the far, far, far west side. You know, in the 90s, legendarily rowdy. A lot of chains taken, I imagine, and likely worse. But it was also really the proving ground for a lot of New York rappers and New York rap hits. And the idea that Fred grew up around that is certainly part of what I imagine led him to valorize that version of the art form.
Look, if you see a young 50 Cent coming in, you know, full bulletproof vest and performing How to Rob in front of an audience for, you know, one of the first times, like, that'll stay with you. You know, that was at like a Nas record release party in, you know, what would it have been, 99, 2000, somewhere around there?
Yeah, I think probably, yeah, 98 or 99, yeah.
Yeah.
And so in your conversation with him, you said that he felt like he was going against the grain and he was aware of that. Did he think of his art, in your understanding, in terms of commercial potential or diminished commercial potential because of the differences in how the genre had moved?
I don't know if we got into that, but I think that's kind of implied. He knew he wasn't like on the cutting edge of what was going on, but he definitely wanted an audience. You know, he told me that he had these sophisticated punchlines and things like that, but that he started doing this device of throwing in a like, you get it, or did you hear that, in a couple of his lines specifically to draw in newer listeners, to kind of point out his wordplay and signpost it so that people
like meta commentary within the rhyme.
Exactly. Exactly. And that's, you know, I think people like Fabolous obviously has done that sort of get it thing, but Fred does it a lot. And I think it was sort of his way of trying to reach out beyond people who would get his puns immediately.
There's a 2012 freestyle with Funk Flex that I thought was just like an exceptional, real, super, super strong nerd bar for bar freestyle. So let's listen to a little bit of this 2012 Funk Flex freestyle, which when we posted it on Twitter, even Bob Criscal was like, that rhyme's good.
Fred Lethal, so it seems. He got it sewn up, thread and needle sewing seams. Had a lot in store for our sold the dreams. It was sweet like A&W soda cream. So the cream stacked up real nice. Word of advice, I need none. Bundles of white, holla at me if you need some. They see me on the block with the Linkin Park. They know I'm selling rock like Linkin Park. Fast flow, they click on my Linkin watch. They see me with the big Cuban Linkin watch.
Let's talk a little bit about Fred's early career. Tell me a little bit about the late 2000s and the early 2010s. I know he was a XXL freshman, which I remember at the time being like, wow, he might be the last guy of this style to be a XXL freshman ever. You know, because the genre, if you look at the rest of that class, all over the place and in so many different directions. So even in that context, I was like, wow, this is like a little bit of a throwback. But tell me a little bit about his early career.
You know, I would say he kind of starts buzzing maybe around 2007. He won an Underground Music Award for Best Male Rapper. And, you know, people like Clark Kent and Sha Money and stuff like that started, you know, noticing him. I will say that probably even before that, although I don't have an exact year, he was very close with D and Wah of the Rough Riders. And he was sort of the de facto person, at least, you know, in his telling, who if Rough Riders wanted to sign someone, that person had to battle Fred to kind of prove their mettle. He was like the final boss of getting signed to Rough Riders.
Which is also not a thing anymore.
Right.
But in that era was a thing. That's great. I didn't know that. Great story.
You know, there are a couple early mixtapes where his style's still a little raw, you know, 2007, 2008, 2009. But by 2010, he's pretty much fully formed as the person he would be for the next 10 years.
The first two mixtapes, Armageddon, City of God, which we were listening to a touch of at the beginning. City of God is a Gangsta Grillz, later period Gangsta Grillz.
Oh, yeah. Incidentally, Fred was also the only person ever to tell me how much Drama charged for hosting a Gangsta Grillz tape. He said it cost him $12,000.
Relatively speaking, that's a bargain. I should pay Drama $12,000 to host some version of Popcast Gangsta Grillz. I'm going to text Drama later and just be like, yo, I got 12 racks. What are we doing? So those early mixtapes, really impressive. What stood out to you on a lyrical level? You mentioned some of the pop culture references. As someone that's sort of interested in the kind of micro bar level, what jumps out to you about Fred's rapping?
There are kind of two main things I would say. First is like less important, but still interesting, is kind of like how consistent he was, right? If he mentions Biggie, it's not just going to be a passing mention of Biggie. It's going to be the next 2, 3, 4 bars are going to be loaded with song titles, lyric quotes. Everything was very thought through and put together in that sense. And I would say also primarily his love of, it sounds silly to say about a rapper, but his love of language. By that I mean sounds, twisting words, especially homophones, kind of like basically things that sound the same, but maybe spelled differently, although that's less important in rap, something he obviously took advantage of and mean different things. He would take 2 or 3 words and make them sound like something else. I think it's that Flex freestyle you just played. You know, he says, call your girl Kim, because every time the car dash, she in.
Right, which used to be like the most exciting thing for me as a listener when I would catch something like that. And you could even tell in your piece after he passed, like you mentioned how he had that similar reaction to the Fife line about Siemens furniture in Electric Relaxation.
That was his origin story, was like getting that line from Electric Relaxation and just like understanding it as a kid and running up to people and being like, do you get it? And in his telling, people were like, yeah, that's clever or whatever. But he just like, it totally opened his mind and he basically made an entire style out of it, which is amazing.
In the XXL freestyle, and actually we should play a little bit of the XXL freestyle right now.
Yeah. Live from the BX. It's funny how I walk around with a 4-5 and a 3X. Big chain, get you smoke like I love Lucy's. Just me and my Cuban, I love Lucy. Finna age, look at Marion. I'm center stage, more lies you want. I'm riding on whoever side you want, black or white, whatever.
The freestyle is good, but what I find kind of most endearing about this freestyle is the look on Meek Mill's face in the video. If you're listening and you want to go check it out, you just Google Meek Mill, Fred the Godson, XXL freestyle. But the look on Meek Mill's face, like every time Fred does a kind of impressive lyrical thing, like Meek's really paying attention. And you watch enough of these XXL freestyles and most time people don't pay attention to each other really, or they're kind of like absentmindedly just passing the time when they're not on the mic. But you could tell Meek is like looking at this guy and being like, okay, that guy's rapping.
Rappers loved him. When I talked to him, Fred had story after story of Talib Kweli, I handed him a CD and then 3 days later he tweeted, this was the best thing I've ever heard. Or, you know, Beanie Siegel, Fred didn't tell me this, but it's an early bio saying that, you know, Fred was the best guy he'd heard since, you know, Beanie signed to Rockefeller. Or Fred doing a remake of Just a Friend and then getting a call from Biz Markie saying, like, you killed it. He definitely found an audience among rappers. And yeah, you can definitely tell in that clip.
So obviously, because of mixtapes, he was remaking songs a bunch. We should listen to the Just a Friend revision.
But you say just a friend.
I met her backstage at my show. She said her best friend made her go. She big fans of 2 Chainz and Future. Said I spit too intricate, something she ain't used to. Her baby brother love my bars though. Walking around.
There are also songs that Fred did that were like, you could tell he's like sort of like inching or at least like dipping his toe in like slightly more broad based waters, like the Jadakiss record, the Toast to That song, which is clearly the type of song that Jadakiss learned to make over the course of the 90s. And it's kind of like bringing Fred along on this song. Did you get the sense when you talked to him, were Fred's ambitions in your mind to do more things like this, or were these just the sorts of things that he did kind of to be able to keep doing the other thing that he really liked?
You know, I'm not sure. I will say, I think he enjoyed the challenge of splitting the difference, and he took between content and form, if you will. And he took a lot of pride in his ability to, in any kind of song, throw in wordplay, you know, even in Monique's Room, which is his kind of breakup song, right? Or in Black Power, his sort of political song that he did towards the end of his life. In those, there was wordplay. And I think he took a certain amount of pride in saying, I'm not just the battle rapper who can't make songs. Like, I can make songs, but also my songs are not going to be boring to the battle rap fans.
Yes, let's actually listen to Monique's Room, which I think does that really well. I think that's an interesting distinction that you make, because I think, and again, this is all very generational, and yeah, people have to forgive me in advance if this sounds like litigating the battles of the 90s or the 2000s here in the year of our Lord 2021. But that was like a real thing that I think certain rappers struggled with, which is, how do I maintain my core, not just identity, but also the particular gift that got me put on in this new context, which kind of de-emphasized the need for that gift. And I think you're right, which is that even in these songs where Fred is kind of like inching in these directions, he's still very much like, no, I'm going to give you this real Fred stuff, regardless.
Some of the best work he did was, you know, he found a real pocket with Arsonist of the Tea Makers. And I think that was sort of really his comfort zone, where he could make songs. He was working with a great producer, but it still had this like New York sort of throwbacky feel to it. Toward the end of his life, he was like a standout guest on a bunch of Jim Jones songs. He did a whole project with Arsonist. Like, I think that was really, in some ways, the lane that suited him the best was working with Arsonist.
When you put together your episode with Fred for The Cypher, you also have very extensive musical cues and notes. As we're going out, I wonder if there's a particular song that you think is either underappreciated or tells a bit of a part of the Fred story that we haven't touched on yet.
Sure. Wow. There is a whole bunch of stuff I would say definitely to get into. I know a lot of his intros, like the one you played at the beginning, were where he would be sort of most honest. I actually really like the intro on the Fat Boy Fresh tape a lot. I think, again, just because of some of the wordplay there is just a mind-blowing homophone there of collateral and could lateral. He, you know, have to bend the pronunciation a little bit to make it work, but just stunning. And I think that's one of the things I will always remember Fred for, is just this feeling of like, how did you think of that?
Let's listen to a little bit of that Fat Boy Fresh intro. This came out in 2014.
Good morning, getting it still like pronto. Coffee, OJ, Marcus Allen, a white Bronco. Fear death, only for team. That's how we bond, though. My peers left, I'm still with the grain. I'm like Rondo, rhyme flow crazy. The hood like way to go. Do the right thing and you should kill the radio. That's wrong, we'll even send a song first. First you buy they wife a Louis Vuitton purse.
Okay. Now, obviously, a lot of the good stuff is not going to be on Spotify, because it's mixtape or it's not cleared or whatever. So it's probably floating around YouTube. But if you look at the kind of officialist stuff that's on Spotify, Fred was putting out good records up until like last year, right? You know, up until the year before last. Like, this is the thing. A lot of rappers of this generation either left the game behind or went to do something else, or maybe they're ghostwriting for somebody or who knows what. When I was writing the obituary, I was going back and revisiting God Level, Gordo, like all these tapes, really, really good tapes. And he never let go of that ideology. He never let go of that artistic perspective.
No, definitely not. It's funny, because when I talked to him about ghostwriting, he said that he did it. And I really wish I had asked him, even off the record, you know, sworn to secrecy, who he was doing it for. I didn't, which I regret to this day. And the way he talked about it was interesting. He said when he first got ghostwriting gigs, he would try to write in the style of the artist. But he quickly realized he was getting hired because they wanted that Fred the Godson style.
Right, which is always the kind of push and pull with ghostwriting. But I think for someone like Fred, it's like you bring him in because he does a thing that you can't do. Like, very simply, he does the thing you literally can't do. It actually reminds me of something I talked about with Bun B about many years ago, not specifically in the context of ghostwriting, more about collaborating or artists kind of wanting you on their track, but then kind of realizing that they can't do what you do. So they are going to look either weak by comparison or so he, you know, talking about like getting taken off songs because he kind of showed up too hard. And the ghostwriting thing is interesting because I'm sure he would ghostwrite for people and some people could maybe pull off what he did and some people probably couldn't pull it off. Like they probably wanted some of that Fred stuff. And then when they tried to have it come out of their mouth, probably didn't sound that right.
Right. Yeah. Be like, wait a second.
Yeah. This is not within my skill set.
Yeah.
Well, Sean, man, I appreciate you calling in and I'm glad we got a chance to look back and celebrate Fred's life and work. And I appreciate your time, fam.
Of course. Thank you so much. And I'm really happy I got to do this and to share, you know, my head scratching joy in Fred's music with so many people.
That is our show. Thank you to Kurt, to Sean, to Ben. You can listen to every podcast ever at nytimes.com/podcast. Get involved with the Facebook group. Email us, podcast@nytimes.com. Does anybody want to do a Clubhouse thing? Please talk about it. If someone can start a post on the Facebook group talking about Clubhouse, maybe that's something that we could do, kind of a little breakout session. Pedro and I were talking about it the other day. Let me know if that's something that you guys are up for. Subscribe to Popcast anywhere you get your audio content, Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, anywhere podcasts. Our producer, as always, Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. To go out, Pedro, I know something, which is your daughter.
Yes, my daughter.
In addition to stanning various K-pop artists, has also arrived at an appreciation of Christina.
Yes, she has. I played for her What's a Girl to Do from Sleep It Off. And she likes the entire album. But I'd like to ask a favor. Can I pick the song to go out on?
Yeah, it's Dealer's Choice. I want a Christina song as understood and heard through the ears of your daughter. Dealer's Choice. I'm open to whatever it is.
This is a melding of all sorts of worlds. She did a cover of When You Were Mine by Prince.
Okay.
So let's go out on that if you don't mind.
Okay. And it better be, if your daughter doesn't like it, she's going to send an email. So I'm going to know.
Oh, she likes it. Okay. She likes it.
I just want to make sure I don't want it to be weird when she sends a complaint email to me. I don't want that to be weird. Okay. So I just want to make sure you're right.
You're killing me.
Okay. So here's Christina covering Prince, When You Were Mine. See you next week.
When you were mine, I gave you all my money. Time after time, you've done me wrong. Just like a train, you let my friends run over me. It's so strange.
Spectrum One is a big deal. You get Spectrum Internet with the most reliable internet speeds, free advanced Wi-Fi for enhanced security and privacy, and a free Spectrum Mobile Unlimited line with nationwide 5G included, all while saving big. For the big speed, big reliability, and big savings you want, get Spectrum One. Just $49.99 a month for 12 months. Visit spectrum.com/bigdeal for full details. Offer subject to change. Valid for qualified residential customers only. Service not available in all areas. Restrictions apply.